Good evening, everyone. I'm David Feldman, the director of the Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Anti-Semitism. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to our event this evening. It's an auspicious occasion, not only because we have four stellar speakers, but because it's the first event that the Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Anti-Semitism has put on in collaboration with the Parkes Institute for the Study of Jewish Non-Jewish Relations, and I hope it will be the first of many. I can hear someone scraping their plate, so it would be good if everyone can check that they've muted themselves. That would be really fantastic. Thank you. So our event this evening, as you know, is titled Heroes? Nations, Memory, and the Jews. And our starting point really is the idea that national identities and national memories have been and continue to be closely bound up with either anti-Semitism or an ambivalent relationship to Jews. And thinking about national heroes is, we hope, will prove to be a good way of exploring these tensions. The chair for this evening's talks will be Claire Lafolle. Claire is director of the Parkes Institute, is the director of the Parkes Institute at the University of Southampton and associate professor of East European Jewish history there. And then the Q&A which will follow our presentations will be chaired by Tony Kushner. Tony is the James Parkes Professor of the History of Jewish Non-Jewish Relations, also at the University of Southampton, and it's a great pleasure to be doing this event in partnership with them. And I will stop there and hand over to Claire.
Thank you very much, David. It's really a big pleasure and a big honor to be part of this event. So, as you said, I'm the director of the Parkes Institute. And I'm really pleased to represent our institute, which is based at the University of Southampton, named after Dr. Reverend James Parkes, who was a tireless fighter against anti-Semitism and racism, and who helped refugees before, during, and after the Second World War, and who founded the Council of Christian and Jews. So his library found a home at the University of Southampton in 1964, and since then, the Parkes Institute has grown and has become a major center for the study of Jewish non-Jewish relations from the ancient times to the contemporary world. So we have a lot of common, obviously, with the Birkbeck Institute for the study of anti-Semitism, and it is really a pleasure to co-organize this event with you. So I will introduce our speakers in the order where they were present. So we will start with Elizabeth Tingan, who is a professor of history at De Montfort University, Leicester, and she will be talking about Simon de Montfort. She previously taught at Plymouth and Northampton universities. She has written extensively on the reformations and religious conflict in early modern Europe, especially in France. Her latest books are Sacred Journeys, Long Distance Pilgrimage in Northwestern Europe in the Counter-Reformation, and with Philip Booth, A Companion to Death, Burial, and Remembrance in Late Medieval and Early Modern Europe. And next, we will have Victoria Ritterer, who is Associate Professor of History at Millersville University, Pennsylvania. She's a founding member of the Academic Council of the Babi Yar Holocaust Memorial Center in Kiev, Ukraine. And she's the author and editor of many books and articles on Russian, Ukrainian, and Eastern European Jewish history and the Holocaust. And she will be talking tonight about the Ukrainian hetman Bogdan Khmelnytsky. Michael Carter-Sinclair, who is a visiting research fellow at King's College London. His work has focused on anti-Semitism in Vienna from the middle of the 19th century to around the middle of the 20th century. In his book, Vienna's Respectable Antisemites, A Study of the Christian Social Movement, he challenges a number of established notions about the coalition of the lower clergy and the lower bourgeoisie that was critical to the development of politically organized Viennese antisemitism. And tonight he will be talking about one of these respectable antisemites, the mayor of Vienna, Karl Luger. And finally, Ludivine Broch, a senior lecturer in history at the University of Westminster. She's the author of Ordinary Workers, French Railwayman, Vichy and the Holocaust, which was translated into French. She has edited volumes and done a lot of research on the topics of rescue in the Holocaust, the memory of the Second World War, railwaymen, and most recently on colonial resistors. She will be talking tonight about the French writer Louis-Ferdinand Céline. So you'll have 10 minutes. So I will start to make a lot of movements once you reach your 10 minutes. So thank you very much. Please, Elisabeth, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Anne, for the invitation to speak. I'm going to share my screen. And I have some slides to keep your interest. So thank you very much. In the last few years, there has been growing public concern in public life over the memorialization of figures from the past who no longer represent the values of our society. As part of this movement, De Montfort University in Leicester has been debating its name, which commemorates Simon de Montfort, the 6th Earl of Leicester. The Earl was and remains a contentious choice because of anti-Semitism associated with his administration. But the prime reason for Montfort's prominence is his commemoration as the father of English democracy. For this reason, Montfort's changing reputation over time provides a good case study of the issues raised by the memorialization of a national hero whose relationship to Jews was problematic or persecutory, which is the aim of tonight's discussion. To give a little context, in 1992, Leicester Polytechnic changed its name to De Montfort University after the 6th Earl, who died in 1265. There were two reasons given. Firstly, the name is linked with civic institutions in Leicester, such as the De Montfort Hall and the 19th century clock tower, which includes a sculpture of the Earl. Secondly, Montfort is credited with having established the first representative English parliament in 1265. He was therefore seen as a figure of local and national importance. But from the outset, this was a controversial choice, because in 1231, Montfort issued a charter for Leicester expelling its Jewish community in an overtly anti-Semitic act. The debate over the use of the de Montfort name has continued since 1992. So let's wind back a little. Who was Simon de Montfort, the 6th Earl of Leicester? Montfort was born in northern France, a middle-ranking French noble and a younger son. His parents participated in the Albigensian Crusade against a dissident Christian group, which was very bloody and which the Montfort group won. Simon's mother, Alice, was also responsible for imprisoning Jews who would not convert to Christianity in Toulouse in 1217. Simon was raised in this milieu and remained a religious hardliner. He traveled to England in the late 1220s to claim the honor of Leicester through indirect inheritance. He became a favorite of Henry III and married the king's sister, Eleanor. As a result, he was influential at the highest level of English politics. But in 1248, the king sent Montfort to quell a rebellion in French Gascony. As a result, they fell out. Montfort treated the Gascons harshly and was prosecuted for illegal procedure, though he was acquitted. Also, the king failed to give him financial compensation for his military costs. Montfort began to consider that Henry III was unfit to rule, and he took part in growing opposition to the crown. But by the later 1250s, the English nobility was unhappy with the rule of Henry and forced him to make political concessions to curb his power reform the law, and introduce a fairer system of local government. The barons themselves then fell out between the king's supporters and those of hardline views led by Montfort. The Earl defeated and captured the king and became de facto ruler of England. To seek wider consent, Montfort called a parliament with knights and burgesses elected to represent their communities. But despite this, opposition to Montfort grew, and the Earl was killed at the Battle of Evesham in 1265, also medieval thus far. But it's the reputation of Montfort post-mortem that I want to look at next, because this can be divided into three phases, each of which has a particular relationship to antisemitism. Firstly, de Montfort was remembered as a martyr and a potential saint after his death. Montfort's body was hacked to pieces at Evesham, reflecting his unpopularity. Yet the monks of nearby Evesham Abbey collected up the pieces and buried them in the Abbey Church, and his grave became the site of pilgrimage. The cause was the extraordinary austere piety of the Earl during his lifetime. He was strongly influenced by religious reformers. He was deeply pious. He wore a hair shirt, the traditional garment of a devout man, and he dressed simply and modestly. He spent part of each night in prayer and vigil. This had a particular relationship with antisemitism, which was portrayed as a pious act. Montfort was an ideological anti-Semite and an anti-non-Christian. As a youth, he took part in the Albigensian Crusade, as I said earlier. He went on crusade to the Holy Land in 1240 to fight against Muslims. And his charter expelling the Jews from Leicester was explicitly for the sake of his soul. Later acts of violence against Jews under his administration in the 1260s were also justified as a campaign against the sin of usury. The saint's cult persisted into the next century, but it had largely fizzled out by the Reformation. The next and second phase, chronologically, from the 18th to the 20th centuries, saw Montfort become a political hero, commemorated for a major role in the constitutional development of England. De Montfort was seen as an early advocate of limited monarchy, and he believed that elected councillors and responsible officials had an important role in politics. He called two major parliaments to represent the wider community of the realm rather than just the interests of the aristocracy. And the Parliament UK webpage on Simon de Montfort assesses the significance of the 1265 Parliament as, quote, the earliest forerunner of the modern Parliament because of its inclusion of both knights and burgesses for a reason other than the granting of taxation. This broadened the types of people represented at a high level who participated in affairs of the nation. It states that this formed the basis of a more representative democracy and can be linked to the House of Commons today. Montfort's parliamentary innovations have earned him a global reputation as a proponent of democracy, particularly in countries with a revolutionary past. Napoleon described him as one of the greatest Englishmen, rather paradoxically. And in Washington, D.C., a sculpture of the Earl was placed on the wall of the House of Representatives in 1950. His reforms sat well with the American Revolution's call for no taxation without representation. This conveniently neglects Montfort's relationship with the Jewish communities of England. When de facto ruler, he cancelled all debts owed to Jews, which caused anti-Jewish violence across England. It came less than 30 years before the expulsion of England from England by Edward I. And the final phase was as a civic figure in Leicester. In the 19th century, Leicester heralded Montfort as one of its own. Linked to his political acts, the new university adopted the name and the heraldic device of a lion rampant to signify its close association with the city. Yet already in 1902, S. Levy interpreted his dispossession of the Leicester community as a particularly vicious and ideologically driven example of anti-Jewish sentiment. even in the context of the times. This interpretation gained widespread sympathy, although, as Dean Irwin has shown, Montfort was not exceptional, but anti-Semitism was common across Christian Europe. In 2001, a group of Christian campaigners called upon Leicester City Council to renounce the 1231 Charter in advance of National Holocaust Day. The council issued a formal statement that rebuked de Montfort for his blatant anti-Semitism and renounced the prejudices of the Earl as being at variance with the celebration of diversity, which is one of the most prominent features of Leicester. But this action was itself criticised in some quarters for its anachronism, leading to the creation of an Evesham-based Simon de Montfort Society in 2002 to, quote, advance the education of the public in the life and times of Simon de Montfort and his part in reforming the government of England. The society remains active, with a website currently under construction, which does not mention the Earl's relationship with Jewish communities. So to conclude, the example of Simon de Montfort shows that commemoration of national figures has an ambiguous relationship with anti-Semitism. Montfort was not ambiguous himself about the Jewish community. He was hostile to it, particularly when it was expedient to be so. At different times in the past, this has been of lesser or greater importance, depending on the utility of the hero's actions to contemporary concerns. In today's UK, however, we are re-evaluating the relationship of the past to the present and whether we want to remember heroes who are persecutory and violent. In my view, we should not forget them, for we need to use their shortcomings as mirrors for our own actions. Taking any figure from the Middle Ages and commemorating them is going to be difficult, however, for their world was, as ours remains, deeply flawed. So we must choose our heroes and our heroines carefully. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Perfect timing. And now, Victoria Hitera, do you want to share your screen? Can you make it full screen, please?
Hello, thank you very much for inviting me to talk. And I will talk about Russian-Ukrainian national hero Bogdan Khmelnytsky and Jews, and also commemoration of Bogdan Khmelnytsky in the Russian Empire and in Ukraine. First of all, I try, of course, share the podium. I don't know, but if not, I try move pictures. Okay, Bogdan Khmelnytsky was Ukrainian hetman who served to Polish kings, but appeared a conflict between him and a Polish magnate who took possession of land of Bogdan Khmelnytsky, and Bogdan Khmelnytsky and his family were kicked out from their possession. And younger son of Bogdan Khmelnytsky were severely beaten by Poles. So basically all these uprisings of Ukrainian Cossacks began as revenge against persecution of Ukrainians by Poles in Rzecz Pospolita, or Republic of Poland, how then called Polish state. Also it was Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, because Lithuania and Poland made union still in 16th century, and it was one state ruled by Polish king. Jews lived in Poland and Lithuania, including Ukrainian lands, for centuries. They came there in Middle Ages, from Germany when Jews were persecuted in Germany. And before uprising of Bogdan Khmelnytsky, I can say Jews lived quite isolated. They were not integrated in Polish society, but were not such a slaughter massacres in Jewish history. Jews in Poland have a choice of very few professions because it were a period of time when main, of course, part of population was involved in agriculture. Industry was not developed yet. However, Jews were forbidden in Poland and many other Christian states to be owners of the land. However, they can be mediators between Polish landlords and also Ukrainian peasants. So they were tax collectors, they were also owner of inns. You can see a picture of inn where Jew is inn owner and Ukrainian peasants around. Industry, as I said, was not developed yet because of Jews had very few choices of profession. However, Ukrainian Cossacks perceived Jews as exploiters because they were either tax collectors or they sold alcohol. So they believe that they took money from Ukrainian peasants and helped Polish magnates. And when start the war of Bogdan Khmelnytsky against Polish landlords, Jews as mediators were also considered as enemies. However, it was 17th century, the war started in 1648 and continued until 1654, when people were totally in religious mentality on Polish land and in Eastern Europe at all. So Ukrainian Cossacks did not kill all Jews, but they killed those who refused to convert to Greek Orthodox religion because Ukrainian Cossacks were in Greek Orthodox religion. So they killed not only Jews, they killed Polish landlords, they killed all Catholic, they killed Muslim, they killed Jews, basically everybody whom they consider as unbelievers. Professor Shaul Stamfer of Hebrew University of Jerusalem wrote that actually a significant number of Jews then converted to Greek Orthodox religion, probably at least several thousand. We should consider that at those time, total in Ukrainian lands live about 40,000 Jews. And half of them, about half of them, perished in this Cossack uprising that turned to war against a Polish king and Polish landlords. The war finished in 1654 by declaration of union of Ukraine and Russia. It was declared in Pereyaslav, a Ukrainian city, when Ukrainian Cossacks went under patronage of Russian Tsar. And of course, immediately Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who depicted on this painting, become a national hero of Russia and were created a myth that Russian and Ukrainian people always should be together, that basically it's one nation, they in one religion, one culture. And when was built monument in Kyiv to Bogdan Khmelnytsky, I will show you monument, then I return to previous slide, there was put a sign, Bogdan Khmelnytsky united an undivided Russia. So Bogdan Khmelnytsky became Russian national hero. because he unites Ukrainian lands with Russia. However, about this monument was a big scandal because originally the architect proposed a different project of monument, the horse of Bogdan Khmelnytsky.
I can't understand why I can't hear it.
Bogdan Khmelnytsky horse supposed to smash and kill Pole and Jew. So under horse, you can see it, a project proposal of monument, dead bodies that fallen at Jews and Poles. But Russian government said that it can instigate national tension. So they did not accept this statue of Bogdan Khmelnytsky, but they accept this project of monument. And it was built in 1888 in Kyiv. So monument located in Kyiv.
You are viewing Victoria Kitterer's screen.
Bogdan Khmelnytsky was a big national hero in the Soviet Union. And during World War II was established a medal of Bogdan Khmelnytsky of first class with a sign in Ukrainian. This was only medal that in Soviet Union have sign of Ukrainian. And it was a special medal for basically Ukrainian officers, commanders that participate in World War II. Later also was issued a stamp with this medal of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. So he was considered a national hero until the recent time. However, when Ukraine became independent in 1991, the role of Bogdan Khmelnytsky was reconsidered. Basically, now many Ukrainian historians raise a question whether Bogdan Khmelnytsky really Ukrainian hero, because probably the idea of unification with Russia was not such a good idea. The Ukrainian autonomy that Russian Empire promised to Ukrainian Kazakhs was suppressed by future Russian czars. And basically, Ukrainians were treated as little brothers in Russia. So now Ukrainian historians believe that probably Bogdan Khmelnytsky choice was not such a great choice for Ukraine. But the problem—
Victoria, can I ask you to conclude, please?
Yes, the problem that Ukraine then could not stand alone. So Bogdan Khmelnytsky today not such a great hero as it was in previous centuries. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Victoria, for keeping to time again. And sorry for the interruption. So I will ask all members of the audience to mute themselves and keep muted while we have speakers. And now it's Michael, please.
Thank you, Claire.
And Victoria, could you stop sharing your screen?
Yes, will do right now.
Yes, brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. And again, second the thanks to the organisers of this event. Lawyer and politician Karl Weger, born in 1844 in Vienna, capital of the multinational Austrian Empire, was an MP. But he was also, most importantly, because of the profile and resources the position gave to him, mayor of Vienna from 1897 until his death in 1910. He sat at the heart of a Christian social party and a movement behind it, which he helped to shape and lead. The founding basis of this party was anti-Semitism, something in which he believed, but it was also something which he instrumentalized as a means for attacking the enemy he despised, the liberals who had dominated Austrian politics for decades from the 1860s onwards. Christian socials conflated liberals with Jews to unlock latent anti-Semitism in the small and predominantly Christian electorate, is one of his early colleagues in the Christian social movement, Father Adam Latschka of Vienna, commented, they had tried everything to undermine their liberal enemies. Then they found their weakness, the Jew. However, let's not assume that Luego was only prejudiced against Jews. In 1904, he proclaimed that teachers who instruct our children must be of good Austrian, good German and Christian disposition. Others cannot and will not be tolerated. So, teaching as a profession in his part of Austria was to be closed to Jews, but also to Czechs, to atheists, to opponents of the Habsburgs and to others. This was hardly the sort of stance to make a truly national hero, with appeal across very large parts of the multinational state. And anyway, late Luego didn't expect to be that sort of national hero. His ambitions were limited, broadly, to appeals to the German-speaking bourgeois population of the Habsburg lands. If he can be described as a national hero, it is as a hero to a perceived nation of certain German Austrians, not to a state. But there are benefits to be gained in looking at Luego as someone who was put forward as a national hero, as a role model for the nation, in order to examine how those who saw him this way imagined and wanted to shape the so-called German-Austrian nation. A persistent mantra among Luego and his admirers was that the allegedly true nature of Austria was Christian and German. Anything else was foreign. But where did this leave Jews? Where does such a stance leave the immigrant population of modern Austria, whether native speakers of another language or adherents to another religion or none? Even before his death, myths of Luego the hero claimed that it was his magnificent agitation that had vanquished Jewish liberals in the city council elections in the 1890s. And in the immediate aftermath of his death, many priests in Vienna, who formed the campaigning backbone of Luego's movement, recorded in their Chroniken, which is a type of parish diary, the demise of a much-loved German patriot. Requiem masses were held to pray for his soul, and, no doubt, to reinforce this heroic message among the faithful. The Viennese Catholic press was fulsome in its praise of the deceased Luego. Social and charitable societies named after him were established, and yearly commemorations of his life took place for decades. And, as has happened with so many other controversial figures, his supporters ensured that physical monuments and memorials were created. Streets, squares, and statues were dedicated to him. Commemorative coins were issued. Churches were named after him. And memorialization of Luego has been used to portray his attitudes towards Jews, not his prejudices, but as part of a narrative that posits anti-Semitism in Vienna as a reaction to changed circumstances, that Luego was rescuing the city from outsiders who did not belong. Those who followed Luego dressed up their anti-Semitism, but held it just as close. Monsignor Ignaz Seipel, who was a senior churchman and chancellor of Austria in the 1920s, claimed that the Christian Social Party did not struggle against Jews per se, but against the corrosive influence of Jewish excesses. The effect of such validation of anti-Semitic attitudes by so-called arbiters of morality, whether lay or clerical, was that Luego became, for some, a symbol of an anti-Semitism that was acceptable, respectable, and necessary in defense of Christian Vienna. This vision reached a high watermark in 1934, when, after a coup, Austria's first democracy came to an end, and a fascist-inspired corporate state came into being, described in its constitution as a Christian German state, which was authenticated in the name of God the Almighty, from whom all law emanates, and which was to be run on an authoritarian basis. In recent years, attempts have been made to challenge positive memorializations of Luego, to educate people about his anti-Semitism. Informative plaques have been erected next to statues, while there has been the renaming of sites, such as changing the street name Dr. Karl Luego Ring to Universitätsring. Now, long and heated debates have taken place about what should happen with these sites, and reactions to the change to the name of, for instance, Dr. Karl Luego Ring are illustrative of the situation. The Jewish community organization, the Kultusgemeinde, welcomed the renaming as long overdue, as did the university, which had been based on Dr. Karl Luego Ring. But for the right-wing FPO, it was a scandal that an outstanding mayor was being hustled from the street. The Conservative People's Party joined in and decried the action as the city council behaving as a moral arbiter. Yet this was surely no more than a sort of moral stance that the authoritarian Austrian corporate state, strongly supported by many who had been linked with the predecessors of the People's Party, had adopted when it renamed that section of road to Dr. Karl Wegering in 1934. For others, Clarkson renamings are no solution to the difficulties of public memorialization of Wega, as seen by his statue being the target of direct action by activists who recently daubed on its base the word shame. Many have called for the Wega statue to be removed. The attacks on memorializations of the man, however, sometimes fail to convey that the Wega was only part of a wider social phenomenon. This is in part being addressed by efforts, such as the 2013 City Council report that identified a long list of streets which memorialized anti-Semites other than Wega. Yet, even given that this list runs to several hundred names, I couldn't see certain names that should probably be included, including that the earlier mentioned Father Latschka. But the physical memorials that have been created are only part of memorialization, which encompasses culture, attitudes, and narratives. And Wega is still portrayed in books, which are as much of a memorialization as any statue, as Handsome Karl, a man of the people, without examining who is meant by the people. He is described as being immensely popular, without recognizing that he was only kept in office by an electoral system that denied the vote to the vast majority of citizens. For many, Wega still sits at the center of myths as an organizer who brought Christian Germans together in their alleged hour of need. For instance, and I quote, "The strong anti-Semitism of this period in Christian circles was above all caused by the overpowerful position of Jewish business people and bankers who had taken a dominant position in the economy and industry. The Christian business people felt themselves forced out of their fields of activity by Jewish manufacturers," which strongly suggests that it was in fact Jews who created anti-Semitism. Really, can we say this? Because sadly, this is a quotation from a book that was published in 2013 by a priest who teaches at a Vatican University in Rome. You would have thought that members of the Catholic Church, above all, would have learned the lesson. But this fits a pattern where anti-Semitism is again portrayed as a reaction, not prejudice. And there are many recent examples of this kind of portrayal. In memorializing the Wega, his admirers have made, in fact, a diversionary target, taking fire away, for instance, other people who during and after his lifetime treated him as a hero and who bore the blame for anti-Semitism. The Catholic Church in Austria, whose priests attacked Jews with energy, the same church from top to bottom that denounced democracy on principle, but not solely, not even mainly as opposition to specific political programs, seeing democracy as going against the natural order of God-given authority. Lay and clerical members of the church who saw Wega as their hero for his part in rejecting modern ideas. This concludes by saying that while these reminders do no more than to reiterate the well-known position set out by the likes of Shulamit Volkov and Eleonora Sterling, that this anti-Semitism of the period equates at least in part to anti-modernism, they form very important points. The real legacy of Wega lies not just in statues and street names, in concrete and stone, but in the mind, in what is said and unsaid in private and public. So I have to ask, is that where, for some, he remains a national hero? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michael, for this excellent presentation again. And we will move to the last presentation by Ludivin Broch. So can I keep asking people to keep muted? And
My chat doesn't work. And may I please remind people who are speaking that we're listening to them on our computer systems, and they have an audience of almost 200 people, and to please speak slowly enough and clearly enough so that we can actually hear what you're saying, because we're here because we're interested in what you have to say. And so please speak as though you can see us and see an audience. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anne-Marie, are you?
I can't hear a bloody thing.
Are you able to hear me, Claire? Wait, should I start? Fantastic. So I'm delighted to be with you this evening, and thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me to talk about one of the most acclaimed French literary figures, Louis-Ferdinand Céline, who is still regularly compared to Marcel Proust and James Joyce, but who is at the same time known for some of the most vile anti-Semitic writings of the century. Now, for decades, the French have struggled to reconcile his literary genius with his anti-Semitism. And his legacy has caused several scandals in France, a country which is still affected by its dark histories, memories, and legacies, not least of the German occupation. But first, I want to talk a little bit about Céline. He was born Louis-Ferdinand de Touche in Paris in a suburb in 1894, the same year that the Alfred Dreyfus affair started, and he was accused of treason. His family was relatively simple and conservative. Céline went to school first in France and then spent some time in Germany and Britain. He left school at 16 to work and joined the army at 18 in 1912. And 2 years later, he was thrown into the First World War. He was wounded in battle in 1914. And he retreated towards medical studies. And after the war, he wrote a medical thesis. He became a physician and he joined the Department of Health at the League of Nations in Geneva. Now, so far, nothing points to an obvious literary career, apart from being a voracious reader and to maintain an expansive correspondence. But in 1932, Céline published his first novel, Voyage au bout de la nuit, Journey to the End of the Night. Now, the novel, which was about the First World War, narrowly missed winning the prestigious Prix Goncourt that year. It was a bitter disappointment for Céline, but one which did not prevent the book from being considered completely groundbreaking. He wrote as one spoke at the lowliest levels, redefining literature itself and inventing a style which shocked as many people as it moved. Céline's style had ruptured with the French Academy, with all French literary traditions, and his reputation would from now on make him a pillar of French literature. He went on to write several other novels, the main ones which are on this slide. But in the late 1930s and early 40s, as Nazism was sweeping over Europe and the French government collaborated in deportation and genocide of 76,000 Jews, Céline wrote three pamphlets, Bagatelle, L'École, and Les Beaudrats. Three pamphlets which on from every page spilled this kind of explicit, vile, virulent, violent anti-Semitism. Céline supported Germans, saw France as being run by, and I quote, Negro Jews, and accused the government in Vichy of being too lenient with its early anti-Semitic statutes. Some, like Bagatelle, had sold quite well, in fact, even if they also caused shock and disgust. Crucially, the pamphlets naturally allied Céline to the network of fascist, anti-Semitic collaborationists of the years of the occupation. Now, Céline was already subject of controversy in his lifetime. His style in Voyage and his general demeanor shocked people, but the virulence of his anti-Semitism, the conviction of his support for Hitler and for Germany, at least before the war and for a while, and the entanglement with collaborationist and anti-Semitic press meant that by 1944, he was persona non grata in France. Resistors labeled him a demi-fou, a hysteric half-madman, and some accused him of working for the Gestapo. As the Allies were landing in Normandy in June 44, therefore, Céline fled. He fled to Germany and to Denmark, and his absence was condemned by the French courts for collaboration, but he was exonerated in 1951. He returned to France that year and stayed there until his death in 61, and he never apologized for the positions that he held in the war. Now, Céline's posthumous reputation has continued to divide. After his death, the obsession with Céline swelled, with groups dedicated to, you know, continuing his legacy and some would say his adulation. And if some of this was challenged in the 1990s by historians who pointed to the depths of his collaborationism and the seriousness of his anti-Semitism, his legend nonetheless continues and remains uncomfortably entangled with French national memory itself. In 2011, it was planned to include him in the annual Célébration Nationale, these national celebrations which take place each year, which honor people and events with commemorative significance. And it happened that in 2011, it was the 50th anniversary of his death, so they wanted to include him in the list. Can we and should we commemorate Céline? Asked one Céline scholar. Should his anti-Semitism cloud his literary genius? Céline enthusiasts, groupies, have played down his anti-Semitism. Had Bagatelle not been advertised as a comic novel initially, one which would make the soldiers have a laugh in the trenches? Surely his rants were so wild and so delirious that they were based on no real plan or intention. And surely they reflected his desire to shock and create controversy more than anything else. And also his anti-Semitism, certainly in the early years, was it not just simply the kind of anti-Semitism he found everywhere in France? Others have refrained from normalizing his anti-Semitism and acknowledged it much more fully, but they also point and point more strongly to the literary genius of his oeuvre, to the new style he invented, and to ultimately this gift that he made to French literature through Voyage and Mort à Crédit. These works and others had already been crystallized, actually. They were republished, all of them, in Gallimard's famous literary series called La Pléiade, which is kind of a literary pantheon. But others still were deeply uncomfortable, indignant, and enraged by Céline's inclusion in this list, not least Serge Klarsfeld, whose work in bringing ex-Nazis to trial and in exposing the history and memory of the Jews deported from France made him a central public figure in the late 20th and early 21st century. Céline's talent, Klarsfeld wrote, should not make us forget the man who called for the murder of the Jews under the occupation. For the Republic to celebrate him now is indignant. Frédéric Mitterrand, who's the nephew of the former French president and the cultural minister at the time, removed Céline from the list of commemorees that year. But the hot question of Céline, literary hero or anti-Semitic monster, continues. And in 2018, Gallimard, who had initially refused to publish Voyage, in fact, in 32, and had since published his works and letters after his death, decided to republish his pamphlets, which had not been reprinted since the end of the war. Bagatelle, L'École and Les Baudras would now be republished for the first time with an annotation at the beginning by a Céline scholar. Now, this created a big scandal in France. Céline hadn't just wanted to exclude Jews, he had wanted to make them disappear. And I quote, "Jews racially are monsters, failed hybrids who have to disappear," he wrote in L'École. "I'd kill them all to the last one," he wrote in Bagatelle. For pages and pages and pages, he continues in his tirade against Jews, Freemasons, the English, Africans, and more, but especially and always the Jews. What does it mean to reprint them? For some, it's part of literature. For one literary critic, if you know Bagatelle has this virulent anti-Semitism, it also has moments, and I quote, of pure poetry. Others still believe that this is part of his oeuvre, and to ignore it is to censor him in a way. But for others, this is unfathomable. As two historians pointed out, his pamphlets have not been bound, they have not been burnt. They exist and you can consult them at the National Library. The question is, should they, these anti-Semitic writings, there's no other way to call them, of pure rage and hatred, be re-released and sold by Gallimard, which is one of the greatest French publishing houses? What is the point, what is the gain, and of course, what is the risk? Now, the virulence of Céline's anti-Semitism is horrific at the best of times, but its direct entanglement with the Vichy years makes it all the more problematic and unacceptable. These pamphlets were written in a context when millions of Jews did disappear, and the history and memory of their murder plays at the end of the 20th and start of the 21st century a key role in French and European national identity. Historians have recently pointed to Céline's many links with the collaborationists, and if Céline described himself in 1946 as not an anti-Semite, but a pro-French and a pro-Aryan, we see instead the anti-Semite for who he really was. And Gallimard has since actually decided not to release them, at least not now. Through Céline, the French are simultaneously confronted with, on one hand, their greatest national treasure, which is language. And the language, of course, which is embodied and consecrated in the grand corpus of French literature, not least in La Pléiade. And also with their greatest historical tragedy, the dark years of Vichy France, the German occupation and their collaboration in the Holocaust. Céline's anti-Semitism is thus inherently tied to France's own identity and memory struggles, and the division between great writer and anti-Semite cannot and should not be a neat one. France's current commitment to acknowledge the dark side of Vichy does not reconcile with at the same time honoring Céline as part of this kind of national historic identity. This doesn't mean about banishing him or censoring him, but it really sits very, very uncomfortably. And I think that's where I will end.
Thank you so much, Ludivine. Again, a great talk. So really three very thought-provoking, dense, and very interesting talk. Thank you so much. So I will hand over to Tony now for the Q&A. I think there are already a few questions. Please be respectful of each other. And Tony.
Thank you very much, Claire, and thank you very much to all four speakers for excellent presentations. And I think a lot in common as well of the dilemmas facing us today when confronting these inverted commas heroes. Just to outline how you can ask questions, either by raising your hand in the hand raising function, or by putting something in the chat. There is, and I see there's James Carrigy has got his hand up. James, if you could unmute yourself and ask the question.
Hello, I'd like to ask a question to Michael, if that's all right, on Mayor Luger. I was wondering if you were familiar with, there's a 1943 film depicting the life of Karl Luger, which was banned by the Allies during the occupation because of its anti-Semitic content. I was wondering if you had seen it yourself and whether you thought it added to any potential contributions to any discussions about his anti-Semitism and also his place in Austrian society.
I haven't actually seen it myself. I did only come across it quite recently. It's a curious time to be making a film about Luger, 1943, when Germany is evidently heading the wrong way during the war. I will have a look at it if I can find it, but I would caution taking anything it says, given the timing of it, as serious, because Luego was appropriated by various groups over the years and sits very much in the middle of that theory known as the three camps, which that film may well address, which was that Christian socials and Nazis had nothing to do with each other. And if you read John Lauritsen's excellent book on the radical right in Austria, it will help. And I would point you at that before you watch the film.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. There's a question in the chat which is for the panel as a whole. I think particularly it's going to be for Ludovin, but I think if it can be sort of adjusted slightly, it may have wider implications for the other case studies. So the question is from Alan Reed to everyone. Do the panel consider that laws criminalizing the propagation of religious and racial hatred can establish the boundary to prevent republishing claimed artistic work? So as I say, I think particularly Ludovine, but if the others want to comment briefly as well, if that would be helpful.
I'll just intervene quickly to answer that specific question, because actually in the case of Céline, that's exactly what would happen. I think Serge Klarsfeld and his son, Arnaud Klarsfeld, who's a lawyer, said that, you know, if they're published, the first thing that they will face is a lawsuit. Because it will fall into this kind of category of propagation of racial hatred. And the idea to annotate, you know, with a brief introduction, a brief or even a longer introduction, wouldn't do justice to counter that enough for many historians. So yeah, that was definitely taken into consideration.
Thank you very much. That's a really interesting question. And I'm going to pose a problematic back in one respect, because thinking about law and publication and taking presses to court, of course, now we are in a digital age. It is, of course, possible to find lots of spaces to publish lots of very unpleasant material. And there are many difficulties in finding the sort of legal redress to that in all sorts of ways, aren't they? So I think that's a really interesting question. It may well be a possibility to prevent mainstream publishers from doing so, largely by boycott as well as law. But when we're moving online, we're in a whole different world, really, aren't we, of what can be incredibly unpleasant and very, very difficult to police, law or no law, actually, especially if people are operating offshore. What do you know about offshore breaking of the law? I'll stop now.
Thank you. I don't know if Victoria, Elizabeth, you want to sorry, want to come in at all, or in terms of sort of suppression of
material? I think the only thing I would add is, what do you do with someone like Wagner, who in his writing said that he excluded every aspect of Jewishness from his music? And I find him completely distasteful. But I still don't believe in banning him. I think it's up to an individual's morality to do that. We should have laws to say if you go too far, yes. But it's very difficult because it's implied in Wagner rather than anything else.
Please.
I would like to say that Ukrainian Kazakhs in the 17th century did not know anything about racism or race. They killed Jews due to religious hatred, and it was continuation of wars of religion that continue in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe. This event should be considered as wars between Catholic and Protestants, as St. Bartholomew Day Massacre or 30 years war in Europe in the 17th century. So furthermore, converted to Greek Orthodox religion, Jews serve on side of Cossacks in the Zaporizhian siege. So as soon as they changed their religion, they were accepted to Cossack society. There was no religious hatred at all.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of questions specifically around Celine. So if we can, one from Sorel Kerbel, why publish Celine now? From Lynn Marie Harper, what led to Celine's exoneration?
Also, did Celine do something civic, did Celine do anything of civic worth? Just civic worth.
So, three specifically, Ludovin, and if you could respond to those three.
Yes. So, I'll try to be brief. Celine has been published all the time at the end of the day. His publications have been continuous, and he's been published and republished. And Gallimard managed to get the rights to republish him after his death. And it's only his pamphlets which hadn't been republished. And actually, Bagatelle was published a few times during the occupation, but then nothing after the war. And I think, from what I remember, he actually did not want them to be republished. I don't really know why. Why now? It's actually in 2018. The idea was, I think the rumor was that his widow had like heavy medical bills, and that kind of the costs, the sales profits would help cover her medical bills. So that was, that was kind of the, it seemed that was the excuse, justification given. But also at the same time, there's just been this huge literature, this huge interest, scholarly interest, especially on the literary side, towards Celine, that's been continuous, which has never really disappeared. Why he was exonerated, I think, someone might correct me, but I think it was a mistake, because he has two names, Destouches and Celine. And Destouches was exonerated, but I think that was why he was exonerated. So it was a kind of unexpected, did he do anything of, what was it?
Of civic worth.
not quite. I mean, I think Celine, he's only considered valuable for this kind of style that he reinvented. And otherwise, he was seen as a very angry, hysterical man who was not interested in, and kind of accused constantly all governments, Vichy government, the Popular Front, of course. And he never, aside from these two great texts at the beginning of his literary career, that is really the only thing that we can attribute, that is really attributed to Celine meaningfully.
Thank you very much. And there's a couple of questions, similar questions for Elizabeth about attempts to change, whether there's a political will or a student desire to change the name of De Montfort University.
Well, thank you for the question. Professor Kushner and I were both on a panel looking at this very question back earlier in this year. Yes, there have been. The Students' Union at De Montfort University have led a campaign to change the name of the university. And there have been debates within the university, formal and informal, about the keeping of the name, the changing of the name, the ramifications of that. And it's an ongoing debate, I think it's fair to say. So there have been calls for it. Interestingly, the university has been sort of, it's not a division of any polemical sort, but there has been a sort of division 50-50 each way. I led my MA students to debate the issue of whether the university should change the name of De Montfort when I was doing public history with the students. Again, back earlier in the year, and they were divided sort of 50-50. And it wasn't through any virtue of De Montfort, it was largely because of the cost of changing the name, which is rather prohibitive because it's bound to change the branding and other issues as well. So it is an ongoing debate. Thank you for the question. Yes, I think it is important to debate these issues, to see what we're commemorating, what it means for the present, what it might mean for the future, and what we can learn from it about the values that we hold today. So having these conversations, I think, is enormously important. And the Students' Union have done a good job leading that. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth. I see Susan Johnson has her hand up. I don't know if it's the question that was in the chat or if not, please unmute yourself.
Hello, everybody. Yes, this is Sue. Perhaps I'm prejudiced, but the only person I can see that the speakers chose to talk about who might have any worth at all was, in fact, Simon de Montfort, who did take part in trying in some ways to bring about what he wouldn't call democracy. We would try and call democracy, I suppose. But I'd be interested to know how each of the speakers chose the characters they wanted to talk about, because I cannot actually see anything of any great value from any of them except De Montfort.
Elizabeth, do you want to?
I think I was muted by you. It's come up on my screen that I've been muted by you. Can anybody hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. I don't know whether you heard what my question was. Yes. In brief, I wondered why each of the excellent speakers chose the person that they brought forward this evening, because I couldn't see, except for Simon de Montfort, any of the people concerned who did anything of any worth to the rest of humanity, let alone their own citizens. But perhaps that's a jaundiced view on my behalf.
Could I answer that, please?
Thank you.
It's a good question, Sue. And it was certainly a challenging subject for me because I think Carl Lueger's a revolting man. So I had to find a way to present him as a potential national hero, which is why I said that for some he's presented as that. The reason I spoke about Lueger was because I had an email saying, would you like to talk about Carl Lueger as a national hero? It wasn't actually my choice, but I thought, it's a challenge, I'll respond to it.
Thank you.
Could I chip in? My name is Martin Stern, I'm speaking from Leicester. When the name of De Montfort University was being discussed at its inception, my great friend, Professor Aubrey Newman, who is retired but still alive and still mentally quite active professor of history, defended the use of De Montfort's name in an article in the Leicester Mercury. And this reminds me of the fashion for statue toppling and so on, trying to change the way we symbolize people rather than explaining the situation. And I think I'm also a member of the Jewish community, and I personally think that was a healthy point of view, that you know, judging people by the standards of 21st century wokeness is a bit ludicrous when you're talking about history. And my personal view would be that we have to shine the full force of daylight on what happened in the past, not to shrink back from that whatsoever. But I'm against abolition of names and toppling of statues.
May I reply to Martin as well? This is Sue again. That worries me as well, because I just have the feeling, coming from the age of in my 70s, that current students aren't getting the chance, because of their own actions, they aren't getting the chance to fully debate the way that we are this evening. So they're looking at things in a very one-sided way. Now, it does worry me that they're going to leave university and never have that opportunity again to talk to anybody about all of the problems, because they're huge problems concerned.
Yeah, I think the current generation of students reacts to thorough debate in the way that vampires react to garlic and crosses. not a few years ago, a wonderful, very enlightened Israeli ambassador came to give a talk to the students in Leicester. And I wanted to hear this talk, and I was told that, unfortunately, there were no seats left. It was all fully occupied. Well, it turned out there were only a few people in the lecture theatre. It was practically empty. They had mm-hmm. The students' union had lied. Meanwhile, outside the building where it was taking place, there was a group of young Muslim female students sitting on the ground in a circle, no doubt discussing how terrible things Israel was doing to Palestinians were, and so on. Whilst in the lecture theatre, the few students who were there were, I think, all, without exception, Muslims, asking or putting pre-prepared questions, which they read from their mobile phones. Particularly get at Muslim students, because I don't think they're the only ones at fault. But this active shunning of any other point of view or information was strikingly illustrated. And it's not only the Muslims.
Thank you very much, Martin. I think I've taken up enough of everybody's time.
Victoria, could I bring in Victoria, who's I think wanted to respond to one of the earlier points?
Yes, I would like to say a few words about why I talk about Bogdan Khmelnytsky, and also why it's a very problematic question. Of course, Bogdan Khmelnytsky did not like Jews for their religion. He was fine with them as they converted, but a question not only about statues and name of city Khmelnytsky in Ukraine, a question about all Russian and Ukrainian culture, because all classics of Russian and Ukrainian literature did not like Jews. And I remember I grew up in Kyiv, Ukraine. When I studied Russian and Ukrainian literature, almost in all classics, novels, stories, I read what Kaik, and a very negative attitude to Jews. So if you throw out statue to Bogdan Khmelnytsky, we did throw out together with the statues of Pushkin, Dostoevsky, also Chekhov, also many other writers of Russian literature, as well as Shevchenko, Franco, who classics of Ukrainian literature, then basically need to throw out and trash all Russian and Ukrainian culture together.
Thank you. There's a question which I think is sort of pertinent to all of the presentations. I think we have sort of brief responses from the speakers, and there's several similar ones. But from Maisie, some try to claim that the anti-Semitic beliefs of many of these figures were simply a sign of the times. Is it ever possible to prove whether this is or not the case, or is not the case?
I might jump in if that's okay.
Sure.
That's actually the historians who have looked into Céline and his writings and his actions in before and during the occupation have precisely tried to show that it wasn't just a sign of the time, that it's quite unique. And the thing is that actually, I mean, Céline's anti-Semitism is anything but ordinary. And actually it goes, the critique then becomes about it's hysterical and therefore unreal. And he's just a hysterical person who's writing this to shock and there's no intention. I think it's certainly one of the like really complicated debates that's held around Céline about to what degree do we understand his anti-Semitism? How seriously should we take it? How has it impacted on others' views of Jews at the time? And it's certainly something that historians have done more of in the last 20 years, is to precisely narrow down on not just his writings, but also the network of collaborationists and anti-Semites and publications that he was involved in order to establish something which was incredibly dangerous about his anti-Semitism. So
can I come in there as well? Because I think that's a really interesting question. I think the period of the Middle Ages in which Simon de Montfort was alive, anti-Semitism is a sign of the times, but it's also a feature of the times. And there is ingrained anti-Semitism in many of the sort of Christian ideologies and lifestyles, and particularly the political reaction to those that we see, let's say, in England. Because the Simon de Montfort handling of Jewish proprietors and communities in the 1260s came only before 30 years before the expulsion of the Jews from England. And I think it needs to be seen in the context of a rising anti-Semitism in England in the 13th century, culminating in that act, which seems to have been in itself an act of both piety and politics. And it's that mixture of piety and politics as an apologetic, I think, that's really, that is a feature of the Middle Ages. And it is a sign, yes, but it's a sign because it is deeply ingrained in many of these societies. And whether we we don't actually have to look very far for it in 13th century England, it's there, it's quite visible.
Michael, did you want to come in at all on this one?
Well, it clearly was something that at various times became acceptable to profess. So to some extent, we can say it belongs to those times. But we also have to remember that there were many people in the period I was studying, for instance, who opposed anti-Semitism, who stood up against it as something that was wrong. So I came across something that said Christian social anti-Semitism was the product of its times. But Christian socials created that atmosphere. They made it acceptable for large parts of the population. So it works both ways. It's not a one-way relationship. It goes in many directions.
Thank you. Could I sort of take the sort of privilege of chairing the questions of asking, in all four cases, to a lesser or greater extent, these figures, as part of their worldview, attacked others, in some cases physically, as with de Montfort, and in others in paper and in policy. Are there sort of coalitions of those attacked who are trying, in this sort of, put it crudely, sort of memory wars of trying to confront these past prejudices in the present and those that deny them? But are those who say confronting these different forms of anti-Semitism, but also we've seen anti-Black racism in some cases, anti-Muslim prejudice in some cases, are there sort of coalitions of those who are the subject of the hatred emerging? Or and equally, are these other hatreds less remembered now?
Could I point you to a very excellent talk that was given last week at the Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Anti-Semitism, which described coalitions between Black activists and Jewish activists from the 1960s onwards, who came together, having originally worked separately, and decided that it was prejudice they needed to confront, not a specific one. I don't have any experience of this myself, but I thought the talk, which is now available as a podcast, was excellent and does give some good insights on that.
Well, no, I was just thinking, say with Celine, when Elizabeth mentioned a workshop we did on De Montfort, where it was very much this sort of anti-racist student body of student union that were sort of affronted by having their university named after someone who was, you know, partly for his crusading activities as well. But with Celine, is there any other sort of Black organizations that are equally appalled by his continuing memory and legendary status?
That's such a good question, and something I haven't seen. I haven't really seen that explicitly. I mean, for things like LICRA to be involved in the discussion about whether his pamphlet should be republished, I can imagine that's the case. But really, it has been dominated so far by historians. By historians who signed a petition, in fact, to get him out immediately as soon as the rumors were around that they were going to republish Bagatelle. I think it's, and this is precisely, I think, what's interesting about Céline, is that in a way, the debate around him is also very much about the French past, not only about Céline himself. Yeah, it becomes this space for interdisciplinary encounters and clashes, in fact. I haven't seen that so far, but I'm really gonna have a look next time. Because I mean, Céline, his hatred is for so many groups, you know, and he is, as he says, you know, he's pro-Aryan, and you know, the kind of assimilations he makes between Black communities and Jewish communities is, you know, constant. So I think that there must be something interesting there.
I'm just trying to, we've got so much in the chat, I'm trying to see if we have a new angle. Please do put your hand up if you've got, metaphorically, if you've got a question.
And maybe David say something about the aim of this evening, as there was question about why these people were chosen.
Sure, thank you, Claire. I think it might be worthwhile me saying just a couple of things. I mean, one is that it's certainly not the case that we thought that the figures who our speakers have discussed this evening were, for us, the organizers, exemplary figures. But they are and have been, for other people, national heroes, and they are still celebrated by some people in the present. As we've heard, that's true in to a greater or lesser extent in all of the cases. So that creates a problem for us. And it was to explore that problem, how we remember the past, what parts of the past do we choose to celebrate and commemorate in a positive way, and which do we choose to commemorate in other ways. And I think we've heard some extremely thoughtful and illuminating reflections on that. And I think that also reflects on some of the comments which have been made, disparaging comments about wokeness, references to cancel culture. And I have to say that, as far as I'm concerned, that's not the issue at stake. I don't think, as far as anyone who's spoken this evening, any of our speakers are concerned, the issue is not about, it's not one about canceling the past, are writing things out of history, but simply choosing to discuss how we evaluate it in the present, because history is an activity which takes place in the present, in our heads, when we think about the past. So inevitably, it's contentious. It's about trying to reconstruct the past in its own terms, but also to thinking about what it means for the present. And that's why we argue about it. And it's right that we should argue about it.
Thank you, David. And you know, I think that's one of the things that you know, I think is, it's not so much about cancel culture, which I'm still waiting to find, certainly where I live, but much more about how do you get a genuine dialogue when I think we've heard in each case where there is a sort of denial of a problem from those that see these people only as heroes. And that how do we problematize? How do we get dialogue between an accusatory and a denial? And the denial will just lead to more accusations. And I think there are good examples where that is happening, where there is a confrontation with the past, but it's at the moment less common than it should be. Ephraim Nissan has got his hand up, and I think that might just be the last question, because we're sort of running out of time. So Ephraim, if you can unmute yourself.
Problem is that commemoration of somebody like a hero erases complexity. So in this day and age, the fact that society may be willing to listen to the concerns of a minority is just a testament to the maturity of the society itself. For that reason, I'm not surprised that in the early 90s, some Jews would say, okay, call it a de mon fort. Perhaps today, the considerations would be different. I can't think about recent Italian Jewish history that at one time, communal leaders were willing to accept something because they thought that if they objected, it would seem churlish that we should recognize our status as a minority and that it doesn't interest everybody. Perhaps, or at least I think that now some people think so, we can be more demanding in the hope that society has become more mature.
Thank you very much. I don't know if this might be a very neat point to just ask for sort of final words from our four speakers before we bring the evening to a close. Maybe start off with, we'll go back to the order we started with. So Elizabeth.
Thank you, Ephraim. I thought that was a really very interesting comment, and one that resonates with my own work on minorities in 16th century France, actually. But I think above all this evening, I think what I've tried to say is that we need to take figures from the past, however problematic, and interrogate them in the way David has said. And with regard to students, I've actually found them very open to debate. Certainly my own history students have enjoyed debating and taking different positions and looking at the past upside down and often coming to new conclusions. And we mustn't forget the difficult people in the past, because as I said earlier, they shine a light on the present. We need to understand them in their own terms, but we also need to make choices about how we take our own society forward in terms of openness and tolerance, and they're really important too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. And Victoria.
I think when we judge people today, we judge it, of course, from our current positions, but we should understand that in different time, people were absolutely in different mentality, and they consider, for example, themselves in 17th century, even not Russian or Ukrainians, but Greek Orthodox, so religious mentalities and dominate. We should understand that we today apply, of course, absolutely different standards. And I would not rush to cancel all culture of the past, even if people had prejudice in the past, but rather explain to students, I explain it to my students, that people were in different mentality and they had different values at those times.
Thank you very much. And Michael?
I came across something recently about the redevelopment of the Manchester Royal Exchange Theatre, which may not sound particularly relevant, but apparently it was the cotton exchange in Manchester, where cotton, mainly from the slaving states in the United States, was traded. And the building has lain derelict for quite some while now, and it's been refurbished and is ready for shows again. And what the new co-directors, artistic directors, have done is arranged for a series of performances to explain the history. And they've been accused of cancel culture and of knocking things down. But as one of them said, I don't think we're tearing down the history of this building. I think we're acknowledging it. I think we're cracking it open and inviting people to really look at it. And I think that's a good aim for any of us.
Thank you very much indeed. And Ludovin, finish off our contributions.
Well, final words. It's a big burden. But no, I think that it was so fascinating actually to revisit Céline for this talk, because I really think, I mean, I as a French person, you know, I was given Voyage to read at school. And with a completely different, well, actually very little context to the book and to its problematic to the problematic legacies of Céline. And I think that tonight is a really great way of remembering about this, the importance of explanation without dismissal and careful consideration of a bigger picture, which actually makes it a much richer picture and which poses real burning questions, you know, the relationship between great art and racist thinking is, you know, not going to be solved. And I think this invites us to have much more informed reflections about the past. And also, I think, especially for my students, I think it allows them to think, to understand more how the present shapes history. And they are really useful figures to discuss with them, to understand that, so.
Thank you very much, and thank speakers one final time for a fantastic evening. It was David, Claire and myself had the early idea of this is exactly what we hoped would be achieved. And also to thank all the people who contributed in the chat or direct questions for their input this evening. And I hope also you notice that there's been no French boycott tonight, that we'll leave that to our Prime Minister. Great man that he is, and national hero. Right, and on that wonderful note, I will, standing up for the national anthem, I will pass on to say the final good night.
Well, thank you, everybody, to come. Yeah, it was brilliant. I don't know, David, do you want to? So I've advertised the next event by Parks, but there is much more coming. So please check our website. Thank you, David, for hosting, for having us. I hope there will be more.
My pleasure. Thank you to everyone for coming. And please go home safely, as it were.